From PRI, Public Radio International.
Winter came, and with it the bright running of skates, of sleds, and the need to do something wild, something crazy, something fantastic that seizes upon lads in the wild white nights in a desolate village among white hills.
You're listening to John Shea reading from Moshe Nadir's My First Love, one of the three short fictions we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The first two stories on this program were read at a Selected Shorts evening called Rebel Yiddish Writers. The writer Moshe Nadir was a 1920s Greenwich Village bohemian. Let's listen now to My First Love, read by the Irish-American actor who originated the role of the yeshiva boy in Isaac Bashevis Singer's play Yentl, our regular reader, John Shea.
This is the story of a first love, and it's not very new, and perhaps not very interesting. Dear God, who has not written and rewritten and poured out in hundreds of chapters the sorrows and joys of his first love. And the world is already so old, it has heard so much about love and lovers, about loves happy and unhappy, about loves that end with marriage and loves that end with carbolic acid. Indeed, is there anything at all the world hasn't already heard about? It's fortunate, then, that my story is about the love of a 12-year-old boy who loved, not alone, but in partnership with five comrades. And this, it seems to me, sets my story a little apart from all other romances. I shall tell how these six students of the Talmud in Galicia tried to find a path into the stony heart of their beloved, who was called Cyrilla and always wore white gloves. My story, I must warn you, will not instruct or educate you, nor will it pick you up, that is, uplift you, and carry you away to a better world. If there's anything I hate, it's to pick up strangers and carry them away. I once knew a Jew who was so uplifted by a certain story that to this day his wife is still looking for him. Disappeared, gone. And I mean to say he's still here, but not with his wife. No, with someone else's. Now, my love story really is written for myself alone. A cozy little story. But if you've nothing better to do at the moment, and if your mind is at ease, sit down and read about a boy, a girl, and a love that took place somewhere in Galicia, in an isolated village that few people know, and even fewer know of. I cannot say that that far village cradled me. Rather, did it coffin me. For I slept in a small, narrow wooden box. My mother couldn't afford the luxury of a cradle. In our village, there is no lake, but only a little brook, which courses drowsily through the gardens of hops, and slowly on toward the foot of a white cliff, where, oddly, the brook turns yellow and changes its direction. And from here, no one knows where it wanders. In the summer, the little brook plays gently over the pebbles. And now and then, a covey of ducks chases a tattered leaf that drifts along the surface. Now and then, a Polish peasant beats her wash with a wooden paddle. Now and then, a Jewish girl washes a window that she has simply plucked out of its frame and brought from home. This stream ices over with the first frost, and you simply don't know what's become of it. It's so shallow that even children can't swim on their stomachs. And that's why in our village you find so many Jews who can swim only with their noses stuck up, that is to say, on their backs. Ours is a tiny, dirty, lonely, frightened, neglected, and lovable village. It's a blessing from God in the summer and a curse from God in the winter. Why do I say a curse in the winter? Simply because it was in winter that my, or better said, our first romance began. Whatever you say, I was not, God forbid, a lonely lover. No, I was never lonely. My first love was shared, with my full knowledge, by five other lovers, all of whom wore the same little jackets, the same little round hats, and curly earlocks that hung down on our cheeks, as still as little glass bottles. But let's get back to the village. If it can be said that a village just lies down, then you can certainly say that about my village. It lies down, and it doesn't move. It lies down and it sleeps away the years amid high cliffs of chalk that embrace it like the white hands of a sick god. The cliffs are white, the mud is white, and white too are the people, white and frightened. And there you have a description of my village, which lies down among the chalk cliffs and sleeps and dreams. Of what does it dream? Of white bread and butter, of coffee and cream, and all those delicacies that are good for village folk and not bad at all for the city gentry. Apart from the White Hills, our village enjoys a privilege others don't. The hops fields. Almighty God. Eternal God. Even now, at this moment, the fragrance of the hops tickles my nostrils and mingles with the fragrance of fresh chalk and the white earth and the thin young trees with their thin branches. Pretty, beloved, dirty village in Galicia. My father went away to America, and my mother wept. And I too wept, shriller than my mother. It was ear-splitting. The whole Sabbath night before he left, I cried, I and my beloved mother. We took him with so many others to the stagecoach, and when my father was gone, my heart was very heavy. Did I say heavy? No, light. Light as a feather. Something had been torn out of my heart, and so quickly, and I moped around, a boy without a heart. Have you ever seen such a boy? I would sit with my mother looking up at the great empty sky and yearning. It was not my heart that yearned, but, well, I don't know what. And I would grow weary of looking up into the empty, distant sky, and I would turn back to the earth, and I would tear up the little field flowers that grew on the hills, and I would rip the white petals from the little yellow cores, and I would count 1, 2, 300, and yearn. All in all, I was no more than 12 small years. Summer went. An entire summer yearned away. Winter came, and my mother sent me to the school of Reb Chaim, the Shocket, a big school with big boys like myself. We learned exactly how to draw the blade across the calf's throat, exactly how to let the blood out of the slaughtered innocent. We learned how to make off with the dried pears that the rabbit scene had sacked away in the attic against the winter. Yeah, we learned everything except what we had been sent there to learn, Torah and Talmud, which our Rebbe tried to knock into our heads by sheer force. Our Rebbe was a short man who wore a flowered robe, and his little beard sprang directly from his mustache and did not quite reach the tip of his chin, which looked scandalously as if it had been shaved. And what a bad-tempered man, God spare us. When he was angry, he knocked the Talmud into you with a blow, a slap, and a pinch at the same time. Or he knocked the Gemara into you with a kick that caught you right in the heart. Fortunately for me, I was a boy who no longer had a heart. His anger and his temper were not so much the result of bad disposition, I came to learn, as of bad digestion. He was a slave to mineral water. And if the bottle was full, all was well, but if the bottle was empty, watch out for your life. All the same, we liked him, and we were proud of him. We liked him because he was often called away to slaughter a calf. Sometimes even called away for a day or two, and then we liked him very much. And we were proud of him because he was known in our parts as the best teacher and the worst-tempered man. And because of this unending fury, we were even proud of ourselves, noble, uncomplaining martyrs. It was during this time that I fell in love with Cyrilla. Who was Cyrilla? Well, she was 2 years older than myself, 14, and she wore shoes with high heels, a blue ribbon in her hair, and winter or summer, white gloves. Was she pretty? I can't really say. And what does that mean, pretty? It means to have a pale, aristocratic face, like that of the landlord's daughter. Cyrilla certainly didn't have a pale face. On the contrary, she had a round, red, shining face. And thus, I could never be certain if she was pretty, but pretty or not, Cyrilla wore gloves. White, aristocratic loves. And that was enough for me. And I fell in love with her. Really in love. Deeply in love. Mortally in love. Immortally in love. My soul was one glowing fire. Consumed, it burned and burned like the bush in the desert that was not consumed. Day and night, at the academy and at our Jewish school, at home and in the synagogue, my soul was possessed by Cyrilla and Cyrilla's white gloves. The academy was the Polish school near Cyrilla's home. When I realized that I could not live without her, worldly things no longer meant anything to me, and I dedicated myself to school and never missed a day. Passing Cyrilla's house on the way to school, I would stop a moment and look up at her window, and then bound away with a heart full of joy. I begged my teacher to let me come early and ring the school bell. I was certain that if Cyrilla passed and saw me pulling the bell rope, she would have to admit that I was no ordinary boy, but one whom she must admire and respect, and yes, even try to win for her own. Well, alas for my hope. As with the hopes of all unfortunate lovers, it melted away like snow under a hot sun. Month after month, day in and day out, I pulled at that bell rope, and there was no change in Cyrilla's feelings for me. No, nothing would come of bell ringing. I would have to find some better way to her heart. Among Reb Chaim the Shopit's six pupils was Hershela, who was like a rabbit, small and quick, and like a cow, he was always butting you with his head. Oh, he was a real mischief maker. He was like a weed. Wherever you didn't plant him, there he sprang up, and when he sprang up, you had to cut him down. To slap Hershela was almost considered a good deed. But God knows that our Hershela was a fine lad and an absolute master at carving whistles out of green branches. Hershela and I became great friends. I regretted that he always butted me with his head, less because it hurt than because it wasn't dignified for a student of the Torah and the Talmud. Still, I became accustomed to this habit and even took it up myself. And with that, our friendship became absolutely cemented. One night, I asked Hershela to go down to the brook with me to find new green branches for whistles. It was on that night that I entrusted him with my secret, the burdensome, bitter, unbearable secret of my soul, my love for Cyrilla. Hershela listened, and then he butted me with his head just like that, and he cried out joyfully, "What are you talking about?" He revealed that he was not at all indifferent to her himself, and that as he grew in size, so would his love grow. Moreover, not he alone, but every boy in Reb Chaim's school was in love with Cyrilla, every single one. And as he spoke, I felt very lonely, yet happy too. And not knowing what else to do, I bent over like a cow and I butted him with my head. Just like that. Winter came, and with it the white nights and the lighted lanterns. The going home from school with lanterns in the dark and the calling out in the stillness, "Good night, good night." Winter came, and with it the bright running of skates, of sleds, and the need to do something wild, something crazy, something fantastic that seizes upon lads in the wild white nights in a desolate village among white hills. The secret of my love was made known by Hershela to our comrades, and this made us all feel very close to one another. Slowly, each one unburdened his heart, and we agreed to be in love cooperatively. For if we were united, no one could speak, no one could give away the secret. But what actually were our plans? How far did our love go? What form should it take? And how, after all, did one go about the business of loving? This we didn't know, and we didn't worry about it. We only knew that we carried a deep and serene love for Cyrilla. Together, collectively, we would talk about her and think about her and dream about her wild dreams, and we were as happy as it is possible to be. And thus passed several weeks during which we, collectively and individually, hovered around Cyrilla's house and gazed up at her window. We heard the cat meow. It was Cyrilla's cat, and we were filled with joy. We heard the rustle of a tree in the garden, Cyrilla's plum tree, and our souls shook with bliss.
Over the house we saw a star fall from the sky, Cyrilla's star, and our souls were struck down with sadness. And these emotions consumed us like a fever, and they were unknown and frightening as the white nights among the white hills, and we did not know how anything would begin or how anything would end. And the great snowstorms came. On the thatched roofs of the little houses, snow sparkled in the cold winter sun, and at night glittered like jewels against the sky. Our village seemed to have gone into hiding. If anyone passed along the street, he heard only his own footsteps, as though he were a lost soul forever wandering the earth. Everything was as white and fresh and light as our own hearts, the six foolish hearts of six foolish boys collectively in love with Cyrilla. Once on such a night, when there was a stormy meeting in the synagogue concerning, I think, what to do about the poor, we six lovers met before the great bookcase of the synagogue. The chair of Elijah, the prophet, was empty, and we sat on it. We! And then we crept behind the bookcase to hide from the congregation. And there, with pounding hearts, knowing that we were criminals, sinners, we pulled out the fringes of the prayer vest from under our jackets, and on those fringes we swore our eternal love for Cyrilla, our Cyrilla. And during this small meeting, which was held in the very midst of the large meeting that raged about us concerning the poor, we kept the secret of our love by not even breathing the words she or her, lest in this holy place of the bookcase and Elijah's chair we cast a shadow on our honor as decent boys who obeyed their fathers and their mothers. To strengthen our bond, we decided that each of us should write one letter of her name with a piece of our native chalk on the left, the heart side of the bookcase. There were six letters in her name, six boys, six lovers. Awestricken and with trembling fingers, knowing that we were committing an unforgivable sin, we each wrote a letter until there stood her name, S-U-R-E-L-E. And then we swiftly erased it with our sleeves and we went out into the winter night to dream our dreams. How we could come closer to our beloved was a problem that constantly troubled us. Each day, Cyrilla grew more beautiful, more desirable, more precious to us. In my mind, her round, shining face rose ever higher like a moon rising across the sky. Yet more splendid than the moon, more glorious, more brilliant was Cyrilla. Each day we would gather in the same holy place behind the bookcase and exchange news about Cyrilla. Herschela had seen her out strolling with her mother. Moishela had bumped into her at the post office, and she had been wearing her white gloves. Feivel had caught a glimpse of her as she went into the baker's for rolls, aristocratic rolls. But gradually these stories lost all color, all charm. There was no real news. Each day there was the same little meeting, each night the same walk over the white mud street past her house, and then back home again. What would the outcome be? Was this romance? Well, we could buy ourselves a novel and find out. And that's how things stood. We'd buy a novel of love and study it. In our village, pack peddler means just one thing, the man who carries books on his back. Books about marriages and such. From time to time, he simply descends on us from out of nowhere like the snow, cold and angry. He sits at a long table. He pulls out a small parcel. He unties a black bread wrapped in a red handkerchief. He cuts off little slices, impales them with the tip of his knife, salts them delicately, and then, as delicately, pops them into his big, bearded mouth. Talking is not his business, and when some boy asks him how much his books cost, he barks 15 pennies or 10, whatever it is, and he picks up his stick and he drives the boy away simply to save himself talk. It was from this pack peddler, when he finally appeared among us, that we bought the love story of Zilibar for 10 pennies. How we held it in our hands unopened and looked at it again and again. How we read it over and over and sighed with the lonely Jadrina, the unfortunate countess, and wept when the hero at last turned her down. But still, we found no solution to our problem. The only resemblance between our Cyrilla and the unhappy Countess Zerdrina was that they both wore white gloves, nothing else. Well then, what could we learn from this novel of love? But nevertheless, as you will see, we did hit upon a plan. And this plan, a very simple one, sprang from the brain of our admirable Herschela. It was only this. In another month, a fair would visit our village with the exalted one who was both baker and confectioner. Until then, we would save money. Save out of the pennies that we were given for the school feasts. Save out of our own tiny allowances for sweets, so that when the confectioner at last opened his booth, we could buy a really magnificent box of candy. The month passed slowly. Oh, how long a month was. But as the time went by, we six lovers saved. We saved out of necessities, out of luxuries, until we had accumulated a capital. And this we hid in the basement of the synagogue while we waited for the opening of the fair, the coming of the confectioner, and the solution to the problem whose name was Cyrilla. At last the time came when we six met and asked, "When will the day of deliverance come? Who among us shall make the purchase? Who shall be entrusted with the money?" And it was decided that since Herschel and I had been the first to fall in love, we should be the chosen ones. The fair opened. Early in the morning, the town was already like a barnyard. Geese cackling, pigs grunting, calves lowing. The fair spread over our whole little village and climbed the hills. The tumult increased, and the uproar of the animals cast everything into disorder. The village burst with joy, and the marketplace rocked with life. Famished men with straw in their mouths and straw in their earlocks ran about and grabbed for food. They spoke Yiddish, Polish, quarreled and mocked one another, laughed, joked, slapped one another on the back, shook hands with unknown Polish peasants who wore peculiar red scarves and hats tipped back way on their heads. Near the confectioner's booth, a beggar sat, a cripple, and he turned the handle of some strange musical instrument and sang a melancholy song. A Jew, wearing a skullcap with a yardstick in his hand, stood in front of his tiny store and insulted a peasant, shouting that the peasant was no gentleman. Oh, but the peasant was indignant, and he shouted back that he was a gentleman, and wasn't the proof his pocket full of money? And nearby a wagon was drawn up, and from every inch of it hung boots, magnificent boots, with red laces, shining soles, and bright-colored tongues, enormous boots, tiny boots, in unending array. And a red-haired man sat in the wagon, and he too seemed to be made of leather, and he shouted, "Everyone walks! Everyone needs boots!" And an officer with a plumed hat strolled past, glared angrily at the crowd, and the black shiny rim of his hat glittered with all the pleasure and pride of being an officer. And there, at last, was the confectioner's booth, the desire of our hearts, the hope of our happiness. On a long table, covered with bright paper, lay gingerbread, honey cake, chocolates, bonbons, caramels, whistles made out of candy, even sausage made out of candy. Herschel and I looked around nervously to see that no one was watching us, and then hastily, with shaking, icy fingers, we put down our fortune, our silver sovereign. The confectioner was astounded. Stammering, we told him, "A box. A box of candy." And he packed a box. He tied it up with a red string, and he gave it to us. And he said respectfully in Polish, "Thank you, gentlemen." And so at last we held in our hands a box of candy, a gift. But what to do now? But before we could consider further steps, there were our four lovelorn comrades to think of. And they were waiting in the synagogue. We must let them know what we had accomplished, whether we had bought or not, and what we had bought. "Bought," they cried, running to us. "Bought. For how much?" "For a sovereign." "Good things?" We didn't look. "Open up." We opened the package. And it was at that moment that we discovered what wonders the world can offer. Sparkling little sugar candies, caramels, and candy sausage that looked exactly like the real thing. And milk chocolate. "We should taste a piece," Herschel said. "God forbid, the others cried. Every piece is for her, for Cyrilla. Just one, begged Herschel. He began to butt us with his head. Not even half a candy, not even a quarter, not even this much, said Moishela, measuring out the tiniest tip of his little finger. With the greatest care, we wrapped the candy up again, tied the red string back around it, and hid it in the basement of the synagogue until we too, Herschel and I, should find the opportunity to present it with our own hands to Cyrilla. I simply haven't the power to describe to you what we lived through during those next days until we were to present our gift. Not I nor any other person could tell you, I think, except perhaps an angel with wings, our tremblings, our burnings, our longings, our hopes, the fantasies we wove on the golden thread from that great spool called childhood would be too much even for an angel with wings to describe to you. I can only say that though you too may once have been innocent and young and in love, it would still be difficult for you to understand what we felt. It was the end of winter now. The nights were still cold and frosty, but quiet, without wind, and without the sting of wind. And the sky was clear and transparent as a crystal ball. The white fields beyond our town, the chalk cliffs that covered with snow, were once again white. The white chimneys and the poor little cottages all looked back on the frozen moon and wondered if on the moon it was so cold, so strange. And it was on such a night that Herschel and I went forth on our mission of love. Cyrilla's parents were well-to-do people. Her father is a man of learning, respected, who always wears a black velvet tie under his white collar. He has built a house just out of town, near the Polish Academy, a little removed from the common herd. Not far from his house is that plot of earth where the sleepers lie and the crosses grow straight up from the earth. And a little farther along is the church with its great archways in which hang bells whose worn clappers are like tongues sticking out of a witch's mouth. At times, the wind steals through the archway, stirs the bells, and it trembles gently. Gently. And you can't be quite sure whether the bell is ringing or not. And all around the bell tower grow mountain ash, whose red, bitter fruit ripens only when the frost bites them, and the fruit looks like bright, frozen drops of blood. Emboldened, with joyful steps, I strode along with Herschel. Under my jacket was the precious gift, the box of candy that we six comrades were offering to the god of love. The night was fresh and clear. We hurried, although it was still early. Cyrilla had just left her father's store and was on her way home. We had seen her. We had seen the blue ribbon in her hair flutter through the window of her father's store. We hurried to get ahead of her. We walked faster, faster. Our boots crunched the snow, and somewhere in my heart that same sound echoed. And now, at last, we were near her home. Cyrilla was still far off. We stood a little way from her house. It was dark. Here was the cemetery, whose stone crosses stuck straight up out of the earth. And now the little bell shivered. Perhaps someone was pulling the worn chain. No, it was only the wind. It was only the wind. And she, where was she? There she came. There she came, nearer and nearer. We could see the white gloves showing from the sleeves of her black jacket. And now she came nearer still, so near. I felt as though something in my heart was ringing, as though in my heart someone was pulling a bell. My hand holding the gift trembled. Oh, the gift was falling, and Herschel went completely to pieces. He babbled. But now, at last, she was upon us, face to face. Tenderly, Herschel and I blocked her way. What do you want? She demanded harshly. Cyrilla, Cyrilla, dear one, Cyrilla, I stammered and took the gift from under my coat. Cyrilla, beloved, this is for you. Take it. Herschel bent his head as if to butt her, but he caught himself. But Cyrilla didn't understand our secret at all. She didn't understand our deep love for her. She didn't understand anything. And therefore, innocently, she asked,
Why do you give me this? For nothing, Cirilla, I assured her. I swear on my life for absolutely nothing. And into her hands, I put the little package with its gift of love. Are you crazy? She burst out. For heaven's sake! And she threw the gift down and she flew into the house as swift as an arrow shot from a bow. Quietly, with bowed head, I bent and I picked up the little box from the snow and I wiped it off with a corner of my new jacket. And still, with heads bowed, like mourners, Herschela and I went back with our gift to our four comrades, who had remained a little way off, near a mound of snow-covered stones, like a grave, and waited for us. Well, they clamored as we came into sight. Accepted? Not accepted, we both exclaimed bitterly. And Herschela butted one of our comrades in love, not any longer like a cow, but like a violent, raging bull. Now what will happen? I asked, and tears choked my voice. We'll have to eat the candy ourselves. And that night, the old moon, silent and sorrowful, looked on as six little boys held a funeral feast. And the large, beautiful candies were drenched with even larger, childish tears.
Moshe Nadir's touching story, My First Love, read by John Shea. We'll be back after a short break with a story by Sholem Ash. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Our next rebel Yiddish writer is the novelist and story writer Sholem Ash, who earned the disapproval, suspicion, and even scorn of the Yiddish literary establishment by daring to write a novel about Jesus of Nazareth. The Sholem Ash story we'll hear now, A Quiet Garden Spot, deals with nothing so radical, but is a penetrating look at a family and its tensions and sorrows. The reader is Laura Esterman.
When little Shimon died, his two sons, Nota and Anshel, made a vow at his open grave never to forget their father or neglect their mother. "Don't worry, Pa! We'll take good care of mother," Nota, the elder son, shouted into the grave. Hearing these words, Nota's wife plucked up courage and called out to her dead father-in-law, "Be sure to put in a good word for my only child, your eldest grandson." She had hardly finished her solemn entreaty when Anshel's wife broke in, "Why only for her child? Let him also intercede for his own children and his other grandchildren." "And not merely for his own, but for all other children, for the whole world, for all young men about to go into battle. For mercy's sake, may they be shielded in the hour of danger," some unknown woman who happened to be in the cemetery shouted into the open grave. Whether little Shimon would carry out these various requests was something nobody knew. But almost certainly, he must have heard all the petitions, for when Nota swore, "Don't worry, Pa, we'll take good care of Mother," a slight smile seemed to hover over the lifeless lips, and to all appearances, his gray, bristling mustache began to stir. Still smiling that smile, he was consigned to the earth. Yes, little Shimon must have remembered the repeated assurances of his well-to-do son. Don't worry, Pa. We'll take good care of Mother. From his native town in Poland, little Shimon had brought a smile, a pair of gaunt hands, and a pair of scissors, as well as his wife, Neche, a gaunt but devoted helper, and his two sons. He had immediately plunged into work without let-up, wearing his fingers to the bone. Whenever he happened to be unemployed, he grew depressed and listless and felt he was superfluous. The Sabbath and other holidays, when he had to abstain from work, he generally passed in a state of lassitude, longing to be at his trade as though his needle and scissors had become part of his being, and he could not endure being deprived of them for any length of time. True, on weekdays, while he was earning his bread by the sweat of his brow, he seemed to long for the Sabbath, when he would be able to rest his tired bones. But when the Sabbath actually came and little Shimon had taken his balm of sleep, he went about twiddling his thumbs. He had no friends, no acquaintances even. He kept gazing at the sky in anticipation of that first star, which, for the Orthodox Jew, signifies the end of Sabbath. "Why do you stare at the sky like that? What's your hurry?" Neche would ask. "My fingers seem to be itching for the needle. It's been rather a long Sabbath." Thus had little Shimon plodded through his whole life. His children had struck out for themselves at an early age, and he was left alone with his loyal, toil-worn Neche. They spent their evenings, summer and winter, in the kitchen. Hardly anyone peeped into their living room, though it was well furnished and even had framed pictures on the walls. Most of the time, it was used as a bedroom. The kitchen came to be their living room, and there the elderly couple would spend hours around the stove, in silence, broken only now and then when one of them would recall some forgotten friend in the old country. "Do you remember Shmuel, back home?" Shimon would suddenly ask his wife. "The one whose daughter ran away with a soldier." "Yes. What made you think of Shmuel?" "Oh, nothing in particular." Or one of them would recall from oblivion some dead-end street in their native village. "Do you remember the little back street at home where Aunt Brocha used to live?" "Yes, where the small town pump stood, and on Sabbath afternoons people would come to draw fresh water." "Yes, but why have you thought of that lane all of a sudden?"
"Why, I just happened to."
Once in a long while, one of the sons, troubled by the memory of his parents, would drop in on them unexpectedly.
"Well, look who's here. Nota himself. I couldn't be more surprised if the Messiah had come. Well, how have you been? And how are your wife and child? They're all right. Perhaps you'll drink a glass of borscht. You always liked Mama's borscht. And you, Father, still working in the same factory in Brooklyn? What else can I do? One has to earn a living."
"To tell you the truth," the mother would interpose, "he hasn't the strength to go to work any longer. He moans all through the night and complains of backache."
"Well, Father, don't worry. We'll look into the matter. I'll talk it over with Anshel. You won't have to struggle in your old age."
A slight smile hovered over little Shimon's face, the same strained smile that was to play on his lips when lying in his grave.
6 months more would roll by without a sight of either of their sons, who happened to live far away from their parents. And if the old folks ever set out to visit their grandchildren, they invariably lost their way. "We'd better wait until Passover and then go down to see the grandchildren." A half year later, the other son would drop in and remark, "Well, Father, still working in that clothing factory?" "What else can one do? One has to earn a living. Mother has to be provided for." "Don't worry. We'll make arrangements." And the old folks were forgotten again. Until one day, the sons were informed that their father had died. He died as he had lived, unobtrusively, and soon he was forgotten.
A single car carrying his widow, his two sons, and daughters-in-law comprised the funeral procession. The sons had asked their father to intercede in the other world and in return had promised to make arrangements for their mother. The bereaved Necha stood weeping at the grave. She did not ask her departed mate for any favors, but stared speechlessly at the Gentile gravediggers as they shoveled earth upon little Shimon. After the prayer for the dead had been chanted and the little group of mourners had plodded off, the widow lingered for a moment with outstretched hands. And as her sons took hold of her arms and said, "Come along, mother," she looked about her with bleak eyes, as stolid as the eyes of a dumb animal, and asked, "Where to?" And as her sons led her out of the cemetery, they comforted her, saying, "Don't worry, mother. We'll take good care of you." After the funeral, the sons vied with each other for the honor of having their mother during the 7 days of mourning. She went to stay with her elder son, Nota, a salesman who was more prosperous than Anshul. The following week, she spent with her younger son, and thus she wandered back and forth like a nomad, staying now with one son, now with the other, until her benefactors decided to place her in a home for the aged. However, before her sons could carry out their decision, Necha gave them both the slip and joined her husband in death. As things fell out, she could not be buried alongside her husband. The grave next to his now belonged to a stranger. Moreover, the rate in the section where her husband had been buried was far too expensive for so plain a woman as Necha. And so she was buried in a remote and neglected part of the cemetery. Thus were the old folks parted in death. He was interred among strangers in one place, while she had to rest among strange women in another. The two old folks who had been forgotten while still among the living were consigned to oblivion now that they had been gathered to their ancestors. Their graves soon became lost among the other graves, which had also been forgotten, save by the patch of sky and the little mound of earth over each. They need no more, these graves. In the winter, they were blanketed with heavy snowdrifts, but when the benign, warm weather arrived and the sun removed their blankets of snow from the ground, the two graves also came to view, wind-sown with flowers and plants from the better-tended graves of the rich. During the day, the sun warmed and stirred the blossoms into life. At night, the rain helped to root them deeper in the soil, and the dew continued to nurture them. And the graves of little Shimon and his wife Necha, though far apart, blossomed with the yellow of buttercups, the blue of irises, with white honeysuckle, and black-eyed Susans. The graves were transformed into serene and blooming garden spots, unwatched by anyone, yet tended and guarded by the hand of nature. Once in a great while, Nota and Anshul would meet by chance, either on a crowded bus or at some public gathering. "Hello, Nota. Hello, Anshul. We ought to drop in on the old folks at the cemetery to see how they are getting along," one would remark. "Yes, we ought to," the other would agree. "I could make it next Sunday. We could meet at the Brooklyn Bridge about noon, say. How about it?" "All right, make it next Sunday. Don't forget." The brothers knew quite well that they would not meet. They had more urgent affairs to attend to. So the years went by, and the graves of their parents were concealed from human eyes and blossomed unassumingly like two quiet gardens. Years later, it came to pass that one of the brothers attended the funeral of a lodge brother. He would have been fined had he failed to appear. And his father's grave haunted his thoughts. He searched for a long time in the overgrown grass, and when at last he came upon the weather-beaten marker, he was awestruck and amazed Who had planted such a garden on his father's grave? And he never knew that the gentle wind and good Mother Earth, at least, had not forgotten the little tailor.
Laura Esterman read A Quiet Garden Spot by Sholem Ash. Our final story, Amy Bender's Job's Jobs, is not by a rebel Yiddish writer, but by a young American Jewish writer who does use a biblical reference to frame her tale of an artist's vexing struggles. This story was read at the Getty Center by the wonderful actress Angelica Houston. Job's Jobs.
God put a gun to the writer's head. "I'm making a rule," said God. "You can't write another word or I'll shoot you. Agreed?" God had an East Coast accent, tough like a mobster, but his lined face was frail and ethereal. The writer agreed. He had a wife and family. He was sad because he loved words as much as he loved people, because words were the way he said what he wanted about people. But this was God. And God was the real deal, and he didn't want to spend too much time dwelling on it. So he packed up his typewriter and paper and tucked them in the hall closet, and within 2 days, to comfort his loss, went to the art supply store and bought oil paints and a canvas and a palette and set up in the garage amongst the old clothes and broken appliances. He'd always liked painting. He thought he had a good sense of color. He painted every morning for hours until he started to paint something real. He was working on his 18th canvas, blues and reds in sharp rows blurring in the middle, making a confrontation with purple, when God entered his studio, this time holding a dagger. "Cut the painting too," said God. "No words, no images, or..." He made a slicing motion near his stringy throat. "Why?" cried the painter, already missing the sharp smell of the oils, how the colors mixed to become brand new again, an exotic blush of yellow, a bluish, greenish, grayish, a new way to show trees, with white. He missed the slow time he took washing his hands with turpentine, the way his wife liked the new, rugged scent of him. God lifted the dagger to the light bulb of the garage, and it glinted. Unpolished silver speckled with brown. "Do not question God," said God. So the painter packed away his paints inside that hall closet next to the typewriter and reams of white paper. He felt sad again, but within a week signed up for a drama class held in a church where the ceilings were high and the air cool, and every scene took on a particular gravity with those stained glass windows acting as set. He played a few roles, and he wasn't very good at first, but was enjoying it anyway, shy man that he was, liking the way he would feel his feeling and then use it and look around at the other people in the class, faces split into red and yellow triangles from the windows, and see they were feeling the same feeling with him, how contagious it all was. He needed a lot of reassurance as an actor, but he was starting to understand its ultimate camaraderie and loneliness, the connection which is tight as laces, then broken quick as the curtains fall. So, of course, one afternoon, walking out of the church, spanking a new script against his knee, he found God in the back seat of his car, gripping a bayonet. "No more," God said. "In my house, no less," said God. The actor started to cry. "I love acting," he said. "I'm just getting it right," he said. My wife thinks I'm coming out of my shell." God shook his head. "Mime," pleaded the actor. God poked the actor's side with the sweet triangular tip of the bayonet. The actor sat in the car, gripping the steering wheel, already missing the applause, the sight of the woman in the front row with tears in her eyes that were from the same pool of tears he'd visited to do the scene, the entire town fetching water from the same well. God exited the car. He waited at the crosswalk. He didn't cross on the flashing hand, but waited for the green walking man. The actor was depressed for a while, which his wife didn't much like, but finally slogged himself out of it and took up cooking. He studied the basics in the cookbook and told himself that patience was a virtue and would be put to good use here. Sure enough, in 3 months he'd made his first soup from scratch. Potato, leek, nutmeg. And it was very good. His wife loved it. "You're amazing," she told him in bed, his hands smelling of chicken guts. "I married the most amazingly artistic man," she said. He kissed her. He'd made a dessert, too, and brought it into bed, a chocolate torte with peanut butter frosting. He kissed her again. After 2 bites, they forgot all about it. God was apparently busy. He took longer this time, but showed up after a big dinner party where the chef served leg of lamb with rosemary on a bed of wild rice with lemongrass chutney. It was a huge hit, and everyone left drunk, gorgeous with flush, blessed. The chef's wife went to the bathroom, and guess who sauntered through the screen door swinging a noose? "No," moaned the chef, washing a dish. "This is it," said God. "Stop making beautiful food. Stop talking while you're at it. What is with you?" The chef hung his head, then hung up his spoons in the cupboard with the typewriter, paints, playbooks, and wigs, with the pens, turpentine, and the volumes of Shakespeare. The shelf was getting crowded, so he had to shove some towels aside to make room. He spent the week eating food raw from the refrigerator and somehow found the will to dial up a piano teacher. But right when he glimpsed the way a chord works, how it fits inside itself, the most intricate and simple puzzle, when he heard how a fourth made him weep and a fifth made him soar, the rejoice of C major, the ache of D minor, God returned with a baseball bat tucked into his belt. "Don't even think about it," barked God. The man attempted dance. Backstage, God waved his rifle in the air. The man took a year off life. He learned counting. He was certain this would be no problem, but after a few weeks, the way the numbers made truths about people's lives was interesting to him. He tried law, but kept beginning a duet with the jury. He found the stock market reminded him of a wriggling animal. God showed up at the workplace and stuck pins near his eyes. So the man sat in a chair. He went to a park and looked at people. A young woman was writing in her journal under a tree. She was writing and writing, and he caught her eye and sent her waves of company, and she kept his gaze and wrote more, looked up again, wrote more, circled his bench and sat down. And when she asked him questions, he said nothing but just looked at her, deep and real. And she stood and went away, got a drink at the drinking fountain, circled back. After an hour of this, she said, "Thank you," tears in her eyes, and left. The pathway of her feet looped to the bench and back and away and back, swirls and curls and lines. God was irritated. "Close your eyes," said God, shaking a bottle of pills like a maraca. The man's wife was unhappy. She was doing the cooking now, and her husband didn't move or speak anymore. She missed their discussions, his paintings, his stories, his pliés. She missed talking to him about her job with the troubled people and how at certain moments there was an understanding held between her and the person sitting there, crying or not crying, mad or not mad, happy or unhappy, bland or lively, and it was like, at that moment, she said they were stepping all over a canvas together. It's like she said the room is full of invisible beetles or water or pillows or concrete. She told him all about it, and his eyes were closed, but she could feel from his skin that he was listening. She went to him and undressed him slowly, and they made love there on the sofa, and he hardly moved but just pressed his warmth to her, his body into hers, and she held him close, and the man gave her all he could without speaking, without barely shifting, lips and hips, and she started to cry. Afterward, she pressed her head to his chest and told him all the things she'd thought about, the particular flower he made her feel, the blade, the chocolate torte. They slept on the sofa together. God put the man in a box with no windows. He tied his hands behind his back and knotted a blindfold over his eyes. He stuck duct tape over his lips. God said, "Not a peep out of you. Don't you interact with anybody." The man sat with his head full of dreams. He thought of flying fish and the smell of his wife's skin, white powder and clear sweat. He thought of Basil breaking open and the drawing of a tomato with red and black paint and the word tomato. Consonant vowel, consonant vowel, consonant vowel, and the perfect taste of tomato with Basil together, and the rounded curve of a man's back, buttons of spine visible. He wondered where the girl with the journal was right then. He thought of his wife making bridges of air over air. He listened to the sound of wind outside the box, loud and soft as his breath.
Angelica Houston read Amy Bender's Job's Jobs. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.